Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hey, guys. It is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun, too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino-style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. On a spring afternoon in 1985 in Gary, Indiana, a 15-year-old girl kills an elderly woman in a violent home invasion. In a city with a history of racial tensions and white flight, the girl, Paula Cooper, is black, and her victim, Ruth Pelkey, is white and a beloved Bible teacher. The press swoops in. When Paula is sentenced to death, no one decries the impending execution of a 10th grader. But the tide begins to shift when the victim's grandson, Bill, forgives the girl against the wishes of his family and campaigns to spare her life. This tragedy in a Midwestern steel town soon reverberates across the United States and around the world, reaching as far away as the Vatican, as newspapers cover the story on their front pages and millions sign petitions in support of Paula. As Paula waits on death row, her fate sparks a debate that not only animates legal circles, but raises vital questions about the value of human life. What are we demanding when we call for justice? Is forgiveness an act of desperation or of profound bravery? As Bill and Paula's friendship deepens, and as Bill discovers others who have chosen to forgive other terrible violence, their story asks us to consider what radical acts of empathy we might be capable of. In 70x7, Alex Marr weaves an unforgettable narrative of an act of violence and its aftermath. This is a story about the will to live, to survive, to grow, to change, and about what we are willing to accept as justice. Tirelessly researched and told with intimacy and precision, this book brings a haunting chapter in the history of our criminal justice system to astonishing life. The book that we're featuring this evening is 70x7, a true story of murder and mercy, with my special guest, journalist and author, Alex Marr. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Alex Marr.
Thanks so much for having me.
First off, just tell us how you came to the title of this book. It has a biblical reference. Tell us about that.
Yes. So 70x7 will seem a little mysterious to some readers. Others will get the reference right away. It's from the Gospel of Matthew in the Bible. And it's a passage that means a lot to one of the central characters in the book. It's a moment where one of the disciples, Peter, is seeming kind of frustrated, confronts Jesus and asks, "So, you know, are you saying that we are supposed to forgive the people who harm us, what, 7 times? And Jesus says, "No, I didn't say 7. I say 70x7. Right. So this is it's a great moment because it's a challenge to forgive those who harm us potentially a countless number of times. And that is the challenge. At the core of this book, it's something that the different characters wrestle with. It's something I wrestled with as the writer, and it's at the heart of this really extraordinary story.
What are just a couple questions that you did want to try to find answers for with the writing of this book?
Well, when I learned about this terrible crime, and the fact that young girl had committed it and that young girl at 15 had been sentenced to death for the crime, you know, I started to ask myself these larger questions. What is justice in that kind of scenario? It is not a question that we really have a consensus about. And that was one of the challenges for me. What is also the role of the family members on either side of a crime? Do they possibly have something in common that the system isn't allowing them to recognize and explore? So that was a big part of the picture. You know, what are the principles that guide us when we're thrown into an extreme situation, like the violent death of a loved one? Do you respond based on the faith you were raised with? Do you respond based on your belief in the letter of the law? Do you decide to take a stance that no one around you agrees with? So that was some tough and challenging stuff that I wrestled with while I worked on this for, it ended up being more than 5 years.
You take us initially to a dramatic scene, Gary, Indiana in 1979, and a garage, and Gloria and her two daughters, Rhonda, who's 12, and Paula, who's 9. And this is the Cooper family. Tell us what's happening in this scene that you take us to initially in your book.
Right. So, you know, when you're writing about a story with a violent crime at its center, there is immediately the question of when do you introduce the crime? How do you set it up so that the reader may have a little bit more of an open mind towards the different players involved, the potential for empathy in surprising places? So instead of opening with the crime itself, I actually stepped back in time to 1979, as you say, and I wanted to give the reader a sense of a moment that had a profound impact on young Paula Cooper. So I open the book with a morning, very early morning, when this woman, Gloria, takes her two daughters, the older sister, Rhonda, younger sister, Paula. She takes them out to the garage in the morning, closes the garage door, loads the kids into the car. She rolls down the windows and she starts the engine. She has decided that they're all going to die that morning. And she allows them all to sit in the car till they pass out. She has a change of heart, thank God, at the last moment, and carries the girls back into the house, puts them in their bedroom, and she leaves them a note. Rhonda, the older sister, eventually wakes up totally disoriented. She sees the note from her mom that says that she's gone back outside and she's going to finish what she started. So in a panic, she runs out. She goes to the neighbor's house. She gets one neighbor. She gets another neighbor. They drag her out of the garage. She sees these different people performing CPR on her mother. The medics come, the fire department. At this point, young Paula is standing outside as well, and she's absolutely in hysterics, seeing these strangers trying to revive her mother, and her mother's still passed out on the ground. Eventually, Gloria, the mother, is taken to the hospital, and the girls are sent to stay with family. But a week later, their mother checks herself out early. She picks up the girls. It's never mentioned again. You know, this is not a scenario where the girls were placed in anyone else's care. Rhonda told me personally that she remembered very clearly no one even took their pulse that day. No one checked to see how the girls themselves were doing. And she told me that she was so shocked when her sister Paula committed this murder at 15 years old, a few years later. And she never understood exactly the moment when her sister changed enough to be capable of that act. But in the process of us speaking, she said, you know what? I think it has something to do ultimately with, you know, the change must have started that morning. And so that's how I opened the book.
Tell us more about the family life of the Cooper family and a little bit more about Gary, Indiana in the 70s and the 80s and this suburb in Marshalltown where they are living.
You know, Gary, Indiana has such an incredible history, and I think other books could easily be written just about Gary. It was a town that was created in the early 1900s just so that U.S. Steel, which was building a plant there, could have somewhere for executives to live. As the town was built, you saw that all of these immigrants who were coming from Europe and Black workers and families migrating up from the South to get jobs in the mill, they were kind of left to fend for themselves, right? So immediately you had these middle-class white executives who lived in a properly cared for part of the city. Everyone else was improvising in shacks at the edge of town. It really grew into a heavily segregated city to the point where eventually it was a northern industrial town that was as segregated as parts of the Jim Crow South, right? And that's relevant background for the story in that by the time you jump ahead to the 80s, the city has experienced economic depression and white flight into the suburbs further south. So it's a predominantly Black city where somehow the Black population that has, you know, there's a robust Black community there. There's a civil rights movement that's burgeoning. There's a lot of positive things going on in Gary, but they just can't get a leg up. And the white population tends to blame Black leadership in Gary for messing up when actually much larger forces are at play. So when you get to 1985, Ruth Pelkey's living in what's known as the Glen Park neighborhood. And that neighborhood had remained predominantly white for a long, long time. Black families were not welcome there. It had started to integrate by the 80s. But the fact of these four Black girls, including Paula, talking their way into this elderly white woman's home, robbing her and ultimately killing her, that had another dimension. People saw it as a symbolic crime in terms of how the white locals interpreted the event, some of them. In terms of the Cooper family themselves, they lived in Marshalltown that was not that far away. And that was, you know, a very simple housing development. The two girls were, you know, Paula and Rhonda were very close. Their father was rarely home. When he was physically abusive. Their mother drank a great deal, worked long hours at a local hospital. They were happiest when they were alone, just the two of them together, because they could just create their own little world. You know, they would have little dance parties to Jackson 5 records. The Jackson 5 were heroes. They grew up not that far away in Gary. And, you know, they would do each other's hair. They were just regular kids who truly just loved each other. And Rhonda, in a way, played the part of their real mother. All of that came crashing down with the crime.
Tell us about the circumstances that bring these four young girls, 14, 15, and two that are 16, to Ruth Pelkey's door. She is 79 years old and a Bible teacher. So tell us how the circumstances in which April and these other three other girls, including Paula, come to the attention of Ruth Pelkey, come into her orbit.
Well, so these four girls who were, you know, Denise was 14, April and Paula were 15, Karen was 16. They all were at Lewell's High School, and they decided to skip class one afternoon. They went to the video arcade. They ran out of money, and they went over to April's house, and she suggested, you know, we could try to steal some money from this older woman who lives across the way. She's a Bible teacher. She's older. She lives alone. She has nice things in her house. I've been over there. Just go over there and, you know, say you're interested in Bible study lessons and see if she'll let you in. Three of the girls go over there. One of them, Paula, has brought a knife from April's kitchen. And the idea is to scare Mrs. Pelkey. The situation escalates quickly. And Paula ends up striking Mrs. Pelkey over the head. And ultimately, she seems to snap and ends up stabbing Mrs. Pelkey 33 times on her dining room floor. It's a horrible crime. When they leave, the girls have found $10 and the keys to Mrs. Pelkey's Plymouth, and they drive off. Within just a couple days, all four of them have been arrested, and they've confessed. And Paula gave a very explicit confession. So from very early on, this was not going to be a case of wrongful conviction. That is not at play in this story. And it's also part of why I was drawn to it. There's something really challenging about asking the reader to look at the situation. Here is a 15-year-old girl. Here is this horrible crime. She absolutely did this. Now what? What do you think is the just response in this situation?
Tell us about each girl's parental situation. And as a result, if any of these people get private attorneys.
You know, Karen and Paula both had very difficult home situations. Karen and April had both lost their mothers a couple years earlier. Karen had gotten pregnant at 13 and had a young son at the time. April was pregnant, I think 7 or 8 months pregnant. They all had very unstable home situations. And Paula, you know, I mentioned the abuse, but also she and Rhonda would run away from home They would run away and ask for help. They told a social worker, you know, you've got to help us out. They told, at one point, Paula on her own went to a police station in the middle of the night and said, you know, you've got to help me. I'm being beaten. And she'd be put in foster care or an emergency shelter, sent right back home. It was always temporary. Denise, the youngest one, was probably the least likely candidate who to have ended up there that day. She just kind of got scooped up socially that afternoon. Her family was doing all right, and she was the one who ended up getting the lightest sentence, although the three girls who were sentenced to prison rather than to death did receive relatively long terms. So that's, you know, that's the background there. When all four were arrested, I will say that the Lake County prosecutor at the time, Jack Crawford, he was extremely pro-death penalty. He'd been elected on essentially tough on crime, classic tough on crime platform, had a press conference, announced, we've got the suspects, we have confessions, these are four young girls, and I'm going to push for the death penalty for as many of them as I can, which is an incredible statement to make about people who are so young. And ultimately, he pursued the death penalty with Paula and Karen. And Paula, because of the depth of her involvement and the heinousness of the crime in a death penalty state, you know, she took her public defender, decided she should plead guilty with no deal on the table. He put up a very minimal defense. His arguments at her sentencing hearing were very thin. And so in a way, inevitably, she was sentenced to death by the judge.
What was the situation in terms of death penalty sentences for juveniles in Indiana previous to this?
It was a rarity. You know, this was a rare event. And certainly for a girl to be sentenced to death made it even more extraordinary. However, on the books in Indiana, what this case revealed to the public is that it was possible for someone as young as 10 years old to be sentenced to death. That was state law. No one had looked closely at this.
Wow.
And which is really mind-blowing. A local representative in Gary named Earlene Rogers, the day after Paula's death sentence made all these headlines locally, she publicly made a statement, did not miss a beat. She said, you know, the first thing I'm going to do in the next assembly session is I'm going to introduce a bill that's going to raise the minimum age for the death sentence in the state of Indiana, because we may not agree on everything, but I'm pretty sure we can agree that we shouldn't be killing kids. That was her statement. And she's such an extraordinary figure. There are all these great characters in this book, real life characters. She was a public school teacher. She'd been a public school teacher for about 20 years at that point, in her 40s, ran for public office, and was really proud to be representing Gary. But she had this special perspective, which was, you know, I work with young teenagers every day. I have teenage kids myself. She had a daughter who was Paula's age. And she said, you know, this is wild to be trying to treat kids that age as if they're as culpable as an adult in that situation. The death sentence should not be on the table. And so she jumped into the story. So you have little by little, people started responding to this death sentence in passionate ways. So, I mean, I don't know if we should get into Bill Pelkey's role.
Well, yes, you introduced a central figure to this story is Bill Pelkey, who is he to Ruth, and what happens one day to Bill?
So Bill was Ruth Pelkey's grandson, who at the time of the crime was 39 years old. We meet him at first sort of in passing. He shows up in court for Paula Cooper's sentencing. He's in favor of the death penalty in this case, like the rest of his family. And that's that. Justice has been served. A couple months go by, though, and Bill's going through a lot of turmoil in his personal life. Not only is he still grieving his grandmother, but his relationship with his girlfriend is falling apart. He has had to declare bankruptcy because of some bad decisions. He feels lost and directionless. And he was someone who was a crane operator in a local steel mill. That was his job day in, day out for almost 20 years at that point. He wasn't someone who asked big questions about the world. He didn't think of himself as political or, you know, like someone who was going to make a big statement in public about an issue. But he was up in the crane in the steel mill one night. And, you know, the warehouse was dead. He was doing a late shift and he started kind of having a breakdown. He finds himself crying, just thinking about the state of his life. And he has a moment where he suddenly pictures Paula Cooper, pictures this kid's face. He'd only seen her one time. It was that day in court when she was sentenced to death. But he pictures her now on death row. You know, he's not sure what it would look like, but it's got to be some terrible small cell, kind of roughly the same size as the crane that he's operating, that crane cab. And he thinks, you know, I may feel alone and I may feel desperate, but there's someone I can think of who's more desperate than me. And I bet she is full of regret. And he thinks about his grandmother, and he thinks about, my grandmother would not have wanted the death sentence for this girl, to execute this kid in her name as the form of justice. He's totally rocked by this feeling, and he becomes completely convinced that actually his grandmother would like him to extend some kind of compassion towards this girl, and that what he needs to do is to actually try to forgive her and try to get her off death row. Not that she shouldn't be severely punished, but that death is a step too far. By the time he gets down out of that crane that night, he is truly a changed man, like a man who suddenly has a purpose. And in the morning, he wakes up, he gets some paper, and he sits down and he just writes by hand a letter to this girl on death row in Indianapolis who killed his grandmother. You know, he just tries to come up with something to say, and he puts it in the mail and he waits. And it's the beginning of a truly an incredible relationship that starts up between the two of them against all odds. And I had the incredible experience of reading hundreds and hundreds of letters between the two of them that took place over years. And to see this really fraught relationship evolve was, for me, it was the stuff of great novels.
You introduce a bunch of other instrumental characters, including Monica Foster. Tell us about some of the people that assemble. And was very, very interesting too, and surprising, that the initial judge, Judge Kimbrough, the situation that he considered himself put into in the judging of and the sentencing of Paula Cooper. But now he does something behind the scenes because he feels something about the judgment that he says he was coerced into doing, or something about along those lines.
Judge Kimbrough was an incredible person to learn about. He was at the time in his late 40s, early 50s. He had been the first Black public defender in Lake County. He'd been the first Black criminal court judge in Lake County, possibly in Indiana at the time. It was a big deal that he'd made those leaps. And he was a liberal. Lake County was, you know, it's always been this kind of blue bubble in a very red state. But to be a Democrat in Lake County is not like being a Democrat in New York, you know? So a little more conservative to begin with. But he was a liberal, and he knew that he was against the death penalty. Jack Crawford, the prosecutor, wanted the right optics for this case. And so he looked around and he thought, well, we have one Black criminal court judge. And behind the scenes, and this is not legal, he had one of his deputies, he told me this in recent years, he had one of his deputies rig it so that the Ruth Pelkey murder and the cases of those four girls, they would all take place in the courtroom of Judge Kimbrough, the one Black criminal court judge, so that if the death sentence was handed down, no one could cry racism. That was one of the ideas behind that was unspoken. When Paula's public defender did such a weak job in defending her and, you know, pled guilty without a deal, made hardly any kind of meaningful argument at her sentencing hearing, called very few witnesses or experts, Judge Kimbrough felt, you know, he really believed in the letter of the law, and he felt that this is a terrible crime. There were three other girls who did not get death. One of the other girls he gave 60 years to. So what are we going to do in a situation where this is the girl who committed the worst part of this crime? She actually repeatedly stabbed this woman to death, and he felt that the only option was death. Ultimately, that changed his life. He never recovered from that decision. That day, when he handed down that sentence in court, he went back to his chambers and he called in one of the appellate defenders who were on the team there, this man, Bill Touche. And privately, he said to him, you know, I'm distraught about what took place today. I'm putting you on her appeal. You need to get her off. You need to get her sentence reduced. And Touche said, you know, I'm going to do the best that I can. And he shared that with me. He hadn't shared that information with anyone. He told me that just a couple years ago, that the judge had made that extraordinary statement to him that day. And so he and Monica Foster, who you mentioned, they took up Paula's appeal and they took it all the way to the Indiana Supreme Court, ultimately.
Let's use this as an opportunity, Alex, to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor. Ritual knows that it's virtually impossible to get all your body's vitamin and nutrient requirements solely from the food you eat. And so Ritual has created a new multivitamin aimed at filling your body's nutrient gaps to support your overall health. What I like the most about Ritual multivitamins and also my wife Lisa is the confidence we have in the research Ritual has undertaken to create this multivitamin in the first place. A clinically backed multivitamin for women 18 plus with high quality and traceable key ingredients in clean, bioavailable forms. Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus is one of the few women's multis that's USP verified, meaning what's on the label is what's in the formula. It's also soy-free, gluten-free, vegan-friendly, and formulated without GMOs. Instead of striving for perfect health, aim for supporting foundational health. Great news! Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/murder to start Ritual or add Essential for Women 18 Plus to your subscription today. Now, we were talking about this mission to try to save Paula Cooper and get her off death row. We haven't spoke about the effect that the story, we talked about in the introduction, this story reverberating around the world, but especially in West Germany and particularly in Italy. Tell us about two journalists that get involved in this fight and how the Pope and the Vatican all and Italy get involved in this story.
It's really an incredible aspect of this story. It's no one in Lake County, Indiana was accustomed to having events in that region reported on across Western Europe. It just was kind of unprecedented. So part of how this went down is Anna Guaita was a journalist for Il Messaggero in Rome. She was based in New York City as a foreign correspondent, and she saw just one of those little capsule news headlines. I think it was in USA Today where they used to have rundowns of just news items, you know, a couple pages in. And it said that a girl had been sentenced to death in Indiana for a crime committed at 15 years old. She thought, is this true? How can this possibly be true? It seemed to her something that maybe this had been misreported. She made some calls and found out that, you know, yeah, this actually just took place. So she called her editor, who teamed her up with another journalist in New York, Gianpaolo Pioli, who was writing for another Italian paper. They went together. They got some money from their respective papers and were sent to Indiana. And they were the first foreign press to do original reporting on the ground in Gary, knowing nothing about the region, only knowing this one item of news. And they went, they met with Paula's grandfather. They ended up interviewing Bill Pelkey. They interviewed Bill Touche, the appellate defender, and they wrote very emotionally charged stories that were run. They were teased on the front pages of both of their Italian papers, and it just took off. Readers responded like crazy. They were offended and incensed, and the letters from readers poured in. Eventually, people started signing petitions that members of the Catholic Church, different kinds of activists, organized. And you ended up with, at first, tens of thousands of people in Italy signing these petitions that they were mailing to the governor of Indiana. It eventually rose to 2 million signatures. And petitions started coming in from Scandinavia and from Germany. You know, it really just took off as an issue. At the same time, the case came to the attention of a Franciscan friar named Father Vito Bracconi, who was based in Rome. And he had grown up incredibly poor in a small village in the south of Italy. His family had been a very loving, big family, but, you know, they grew up in a couple of rooms, dirt floor. They were only able to go to school for a couple years. They helped the family with their vineyard and, you know, they had a donkey. You know, it was extremely primitive living. And he read that, you know, this girl grew up in a very modest home in Gary, and he immediately felt some kind of kinship to that, even though their lives had been so different. He thought, you know, she doesn't have money. Who's going to help her? Her parents have abandoned her. You know what? It's going to be me. And he flew to Indianapolis wearing the brown friar's robe that I think a lot of people think of from the movies, you know, with the hooded brown right. robe with the white rope belt. And he shows up to go visit her on death row and just says, you know, myself and other members of the church were very concerned about the news of your case. I came here to be your friend. We're going to do whatever we can to try to help you. And he starts drumming up more attention in the Italian media. And he gives interviews whenever he can to the press in Indiana, knowing that it's an exotic sight. See this man flown in from Rome in the friar's robe. So it kind of gives him a way in to making comments on the case as an outsider. Eventually, it goes all the way to the Pope. The Pope was coming to visit America to see President Reagan and to travel around to multiple cities. One of the two Italian journalists I mentioned, Giampaolo Pioli, got a handwritten letter from Paula Cooper on death row. He ended up carrying that letter with him on the Pope's plane. He was part of the press junket of journalists covering some of this trip and managed to get it passed into the hands of Pope John Paul II himself. And eventually that led to the Pope, through a spokesperson, making a statement that the Pope would like to see the sentence of this young woman on death row in America commuted. And it was truly an extraordinary sequence of events that led to that moment.
Meanwhile, you chronicled that there are extraordinary efforts in the U.S., including Monica Foster, but also A professor of criminal law, Victor Strebs, comes along with some fascinating research and joins this cause. Tell us about what he has to offer.
Yes, Victor Strebs. He is a really fascinating character. As someone who does a lot of research for her work and is a little nerdy that way, I really related to him as sort of a nerdy superhero in this story. And I'll explain, you know, he was a law school professor in Cleveland, originally grown up in Indiana. His family had been in Indiana for generations. And he had a gift with the law, was the first person in his family to have a white collar job like that. And he lacked a sense of focus. What was his field going to be? How could he stand out from all the other legal scholars trying to publish papers? And he started doing some work in juvenile court locally to try to understand some of the issues facing the sentencing of kids. In the process of doing that, he met for the first time some kids who were charged with violent crimes. And, you know, his wheels started turning. And he began to think about the fact that capital punishment was still on the books for kids in America, across the country, in a number of states. He also realized that this wasn't an issue people were addressing at all. It wasn't being debated. So the U.S. Supreme Court around that same time took on a case called Eddings versus Oklahoma that was the very first time in the history of this country that the highest court discussed the death penalty for juveniles, where the justices actually debated openly, well, how can we know what the right minimum age is for death? And it became clear that they had nothing to base their discussion on, really. There was no precedent. And it's really hard to draw a line in the sand and say, okay, a person is mature at this age, immature at that age, okay, then the death sentence applies. Victor followed this case really closely and was really inspired. He thought, oh my God, the stakes are so high. This is what I'm going to specialize on, this issue. So almost single-handedly, with help from a few others along the way, he really was the godfather of this movement of people trying to look into and challenge the death penalty for teenagers. And because of his research, you know, he went and did this very unsexy work of collecting data about this relatively unknown phenomenon in this country. He revealed that we have executed more than 300 young people in this country, and we've sentenced to death more than 200 teenagers since the 70s. So this is not just some sort of, you know, colonial times problem. This is an active problem in the country in that moment. He ends up being approached by Bill Touche and asked to join the appellate team for Paula Cooper, which ended up making an enormous difference. And so the two of them got to team up and join in the oral argument before the Indiana Supreme Court. And I learned about how that played out from both of them, but also by interviewing repeatedly the man who at the time was Chief Justice for the court, Randall Shepard, which was kind of extraordinary to get a sense of the inner workings of that process from someone on a state Supreme Court.
What was that oral argument, other than the constitutionality, the question, but what was part of their argument? What was it based on? What were the issues?
Well, so at the same time that Victor had been working on and aware of the Paula Cooper case, he was at work on another case that happened to be set in Oklahoma called Thompson versus Oklahoma. There was a young man whose death penalty appeal was coming before the U.S. Supreme Court. Victor took part in, you know, making that argument before the court. And what the court decided was that it was what's called a plurality. They didn't have a majority decision, but a plurality, which means it's not a binding decision, but it's taken as a suggestion by the court to lower courts around the country that 15 was too young for the death sentence. Paula Cooper, as we've just discussed, was 15 at the time of her crime. So he then goes full bore into Paula Cooper's appeal. And one of the big things, big statements he's able to make before the state Supreme Court in Indiana is, well, the U.S. Supreme Court just decided with a plurality that 15 is too young. So at the same time, we have Earlene Rogers, who at the time was a public school teacher, as I mentioned, but also an elected official. She was pushing to raise the minimum age for death in Indiana from 10 to, you know, her goal was 16. She succeeded. Not long before Paula's case reached the state Supreme Court. And so Victor Stribe and Bill Touche were also able to say, well, look, now we have a new minimum age for the death penalty in the state of Indiana. Is it fair to say that Paula Cooper will still get the death sentence because she was sentenced right before this new bill went into effect?
Right.
And that was the core of the argument. And ultimately, you know, the state Supreme Court had to agree that her sentence had to just the just thing. And the only way to follow legal logic in this scenario was to commute her sentence.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second here for these messages.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now, you say the only option left was to commute her sentence. What was the sentence commuted to?
So she was given 60 years. What that effectively means, however, in Indiana is if you are on good behavior for your time in prison, that time can sometimes be cut down almost by half. So ultimately, it's up to you. But if you serve your time well, there's a high incentive to do so. A 60-year sentence could mean 30, or it could mean even less. So that was factored in. At the time, being so young, what some of her team discovered is that she felt in some ways she'd won, but I think the reality was that the weight of that prison sentence then really came down on her, because what she'd won was not her freedom. You know, she won a significant amount of her adult life in prison rather than the death sentence.
You write about Bill and his mission. Other than having a relationship and offering this forgiveness, and what else does Bill embark on at the same time as this correspondence?
It's pretty incredible. While Bill is corresponding with Paula, he's also doing everything he can to spread the word about his feelings about Paula's death sentence and his anti-death penalty stance to as many journalists as possible. He was actually flown to Italy to speak on Italian television about this case and his anti-death penalty beliefs. At the same time, as a result of that, in spite of being someone who was not political, did not have any relationships with activists or public organizations, and, you know, someone who really just had a very normal life, as a result of all of this speaking out, he ends up meeting people who connect him with the ACLU, with Amnesty International. He starts going to rallies. He starts marching, you know, in demonstrations that are coming up that are against the death penalty. And, you know, he's surrounded by all these college kids and progressive people who are like, you know, some of them are kind of hippie-ish. He's the one showing up in a pressed gray suit. He carries a copy of the Bible. People are like, is this guy like a Republican who's on our side? You know, he was taking a risk. You know, he was dipping his toes into water that was very unfamiliar for him. And in the process of doing that, he's really shocked at one event when he meets someone who's also a murder victim's family member who has started to say publicly that they were against the death penalty in their family member's case. And then he meets someone else like that. And then they start to put together a loose kind of collective of murder victims' family members who don't believe in the death sentence, who are based all around the country. And that becomes this other storyline that evolves where, you know, they become almost like an improvised second family to each other, where they're able to understand something really fundamental about each other's lives and help each other out and brainstorm together about ways that they can have a voice in the system.
You write about Rhonda, and Rhonda, her sister, is a central figure in this story as well. They correspond and visit during her time in prison. And then finally, it comes time for her to be released. But other than that, what are some of the important things that she'd like to make right in her life?
So as Paula continued to do time, she, you know, eventually her sister would visit her repeatedly and they were in contact over the phone. That connection was really vital and really important and a big part of Paula's survival throughout her incarceration. Eventually, Rhonda was able to convince their mother to come and visit Paula as well. And she visited a number of times. And Paula began to fantasize about them all having a functional, happy family relationship once she eventually got out. I think her mother also made an effort a number of times to get sober, to try to mend things with her younger daughter. But my understanding is that was always quite short-lived. So when Paula got out, she was in her mid-40s. It was already kind of late for her to start her own family. She'd always wanted to have a bunch of kids. That was really, you know, that was ironically, you know, having grown up in such a difficult family situation, that was sort of the number one romantic idea she had when she was released, that I'm going to meet someone, I'm going to have all these kids, I'm going to make good with my mother, we're all going to be this happy family, and Rhonda and I and everybody else will have holidays together. And Rhonda just saw this as a disaster waiting to happen. You know, she told her, I've been out here the whole time, and this woman is not who you want to believe she is. And, you know, she had all this support from her sister she was so close to and other people in her life. Monica Foster remained a really great friend and relationship for her and gave her a great job when she got out. But I think we can all relate to this. You know, whatever kind of household you grew up in, we all have a tie to our parents. However they treated us when we were young, that's a bond that you cannot fully shake off and you can't ever become totally independent of. So she wanted her mother's approval. She wanted to find love there. And her mother made it very clear at a certain point that she was still ashamed of her daughter. And she did not want to be publicly associated with her. And that had a huge impact on Paula. You know, it's ironic that her victim's grandson wants to be associated with her publicly, but her own mother does not.
So she is released from prison, and as many people might have hoped for, be able to put her life back together. But she expressed to her sister, I believe, or a dear friend about the pain that she was encountering. Tell us about what she felt was this pain that wouldn't go away.
I think that ultimately, you know, anyone who's incarcerated for so long, for Paula was 27 years of incarceration. That is, there's an enormous toll on your mental health. I think that really came into play.
Right.
But also the fact that she was able to mature eventually while she was still incarcerated. You know, years went by and she was able to start doing some kind of work on herself, to educate herself, she did a lot of work for other women in the facilities where she was incarcerated, just stuff to help people out, kind of like good deeds. You know, if it was someone's birthday and she knew they didn't have anyone coming to see them or sending them gifts, she would throw a little party for them. You know, she would, if someone new entered the prison, she would buy a pair of shoes for them. You know, things where there was no tit for tat. It was really just trying to make the lives of some of these other women easy. So she evolved as a person. The downside of that potentially, you know, this is my theory, is that it made her someone who was more capable of experiencing really profound remorse around the crime she committed as a young person. And she was upfront about that with a couple people very close to her. And when she got out, you know, I took a life and I'm never going to be worthy. That was how she felt. And, you know, it's unclear if anything could have been done but to help her, but that was ultimately why she chose to take her own life.
Along the way, there was a lot of research regarding a juvenile and adolescent minds. You include a lot of this where it seemed to be that modern science was pointing towards origins and understanding the brain and especially the adolescent brain. Tell us a little bit about some of the research that was worked on and uncovered in as part of this case.
What was so fascinating about looking at the bigger picture of the death penalty for juveniles, you know, starting with Paula's very personalized situation and going up to the Supreme Court case in 2005, you know, along the way, you could see changes in the way that we were thinking about teenagers in the system and developmentally. So at first, the argument against sentencing kids to death was essentially a moral one. You know, how can we hold kids as responsible as adults? We don't see them as adults in other ways. And what does it say about us to be executing someone at 15, 16, 17. Eventually, however, an added component entered the picture, which was the, you know, neuroscience about adolescent brain development. What was discovered is that the human brain is not fully developed until, you know, possibly as late as 24, 25. So you're looking at a situation where if a teenager commits a violent crime, their brain is less capable of impulse control, of a lot of the kind of thinking that we associate with ethical decision-making, right? And they're much more susceptible to behaving under the influence of peer pressure. So in Ruth Pelkey's death, you not only had someone who was just 15 years old at the time of the crime, but who was in this group dynamic of these other girls where they were potentially kind of egging each other on and things got out of hand. There suddenly was, by the 90s and the early 2000s, science that supported this idea. So for the Roper v. Simmons case in 2005 that finally ends the death penalty for kids, for people under 18, that was a component that the sitting justices found really compelling.
You also talk about Bill Pelkey and what happens afterwards. Tell us.
Well, Bill Pelkey and this collective of other murder victims' family members, they end up forming a group. At first, there's a group called Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation. And eventually, Bill and this core group form something called The Journey. And they end up traveling through different states at different moments, tackling different death penalty states around the country, basically going on these 2-week long nonstop lecture tours that can drum up a lot of press. And they're telling their stories, the story of the toughest moments in their lives in front of the public, in front of the press, in any of these death penalty states, to just drum up an awareness of the fact that the victims' families do not always agree with the death sentence. This should not be a given. We've got to look at this issue more closely. And it creates an extraordinary new wing of the victims' rights movement that, you know, was another extension of this incredible story. You know, starting with this one violent event in Gary, Indiana, it was incredible to see how it spurred on so many people to take action in ways that had big ramifications around the country.
I want to thank you very much, Alex Marr, for coming on and talking about 70 times 7, a true story of murder and mercy. For those people that might want to take a look at more information about this book, do you have a website and do you do any social media?
Absolutely. So my website is alex-marr.com. And on Instagram and Twitter, my handle is _Alex_Marr. And you can find me on there way too frequently.
Thank you so much, Alex Marr, for coming on and talking about your incredible book, 70 times 7, A True Story of Murder and Mercy. You have a great evening. And thank you so much for this interview.
Thank you so much.
Good night.